Joining us today, we have Dr. Mary Politi. She is an assistant professor in the Division of Public Health Sciences within the Department of Surgery at Washington University in the St. Louis School of Medicine. We are very thankful to have Mary joining us today. And at this time, Mary, are you ready to share your screen?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. You should have that pop up now. Great. We're all set.
Great. Thank you so much for the introduction and for inviting me to speak. I wanted to talk today about shared decision-making implementation and talk about some challenges and opportunities we have as a field. I wanted to acknowledge Dominic Krosh at the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation and Angie Fagerlin at University of Michigan and the VA Ann Arbor. We put on a short course at the Society for Medical Decision-Making meeting in the fall, and so we put this together collaboratively, some of the slides. So I'm having some trouble going forward here. I don't know what's happened. Oh, there we go. So I think it was the poll issues. So I wanted to first start by asking about people's interest in shared decision making and your background. So at this point, I think there will be a poll question that could pop up. And just let me know if your background is as a clinician, a researcher, a policymaker, or another background.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So for our attendees, you should be able to see the poll question on your screen at this time. Once again, please check all that apply. Is your interest in shared decision making for as a clinician, researcher, policy implementation, or other? It looks like we've got a very responsive group today, so we appreciate that. It helps us know where to guide the presentation and where to place emphasis. So it looks like we've had just about 80% of our audience vote. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share those results. Mary, do you want to talk through those real quick?
Great. Okay. It looks like we have a good mix, but a lot of people are interested in research, although there's probably more than one option can be relevant to people. So that's helpful to know.
Thank you. And we'll just move right into our next poll question here.
The next thing I wanted to know is just your knowledge of shared decision making and your background. If you have no background in shared decision making, a little bit, a lot, or any combination of those.
Thank you. So once again, for our attendees, please select the option or options that best describe your knowledge of SDM. Please note that these are anonymous answers, so you will not be penalized if you're on the lower end of knowledge of decision making.
The reason I let people choose more than one option for this is that I know as decision researchers, we have a hard time making choices ourselves sometimes, so you may feel like you're in between too.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we've had about 85% of our audience vote. That's great.
Great.
So I'll go ahead and close that out and share those results.
Okay, good. So a mix, but not too many people feeling really confident in knowing all about shared decision making. So I will try to tailor some of what I discuss to your responses.
Thank you. And you should have the pop-up to share your screen.
Great.
Excellent.
So I won't spend too much time on the background, but shared decision-making in general has been defined by as a process through which decisions are made collaboratively by doctors and patients or other clinicians and patients, informed by the best evidence available, so it's evidence-based medicine, but it's also weighted according to specific characteristics and values of patients, so incorporating patients' input as well. Some of the steps in shared decision-making involve first just identifying some situations where shared decision-making is appropriate. A lot of people skip over that and think we should do this all the time or we should never do it. And just even acknowledging that to patients is one of the first two steps. Sometimes patients are unaware there is even a decision to be made. Describing the options to patients, including uncertainty about choices, is important before listening their preferences and values. So this way they can actually understand what it is they're being asked to trade off and what it is they're being asked to provide some feedback on. And then collaboratively agreeing on a plan for next steps once the decision is made together. In terms of shared decision-making research, similar goals, but we often talk about developing and promoting the use of methods to deal with some of these uncertainties and decisions. We develop and evaluate tools based on these methods to help patients and the public make decisions, and we also develop clinical decision support tools for clinicians. So based on some of these principles, but a slightly different focus in research. And a lot of people ask, you know, where are we in terms of implementing shared decision-making? Are we there yet?
Mary,
yes?
I apologize for interrupting. Is it possible for you to increase the volume a little bit on your microphone?
Sure.
Thank you.
I can figure out where that is here.
Or I guess just pretend you're in a lecture hall.
Yes. Is that any better? I just turned it up a bit.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay. A lot of people ask the question, are we there yet, and how far along are we in terms of implementation? Because a lot of providers think we're already doing this, we're already engaging in shared decision making. And we actually looked at this in research context, and one of the earlier studies that looked at 1,057 audio taped encounters across 3,552 decisions looked at whether decisions met the most basic definition of a fully informed decision. And their definition was that the clinician discussed the nature of the decision, the patient played a role in the decision making, and they did some exploration of patient preferences. So I wanted to ask you, what percentage of encounters do you think met these basic definitions?
Thank you. So as Dr. Politi just said, what proportion of decisions met most basic definition of fully informed decisions? The answer options are 0%, 10%, 25%, 50%, or 75%. And again, these are anonymous answers, so there's really no wrong answer at this point in time. Looks like we have, again, about 80% of our audience has voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share those results.
Great. So it looks like a lot of people picked 10%, which is the closest answer. It's actually 9% of people, 9% of consultations met fully informed decisions. But as you can see, it wasn't very high. I don't know if you can switch back to the slides. There we go. So in terms of describing fully informed decisions, then the next more recent study looked in particularly at men aged 50 to 74 years old in the National Health Interview Studies. This was a large nationally representative sample of 3,427 men. And 64% of them reported no shared decision-making in, when they were discussing PSA screening. About 28% reported one to two elements, so partial shared decision-making, and only 8% reported all three elements or full shared decision-making, so pretty consistent with the earlier study, which was done across multiple health contexts. In the study of people making decisions about elective surgery, so 1,034 preoperative elective surgery patients, 34% have at least one critical, important, or concerning deficit in their surgical decision-making. And 50% had at least one deficit in advanced care planning. So these were people making decisions that could involve some risk and didn't actually engage in some important discussions with their clinicians. And a study of people 40 years or older who had experienced or discussed with a healthcare provider one to 10 decisions in the past 2 years. This is from the national, a national study across multiple encounters. Very few patients were asked about their preferences for medications across hypertension, elevated cholesterol, or having or screening decisions about having mammograms. And the studies found that they discussed the pros much more than the cons across all 10 decisions that they were asked to consider. And this is really common in shared decision making. So clinicians may say we do this all the time, but the evidence doesn't actually suggest that we're doing this, at least not in full. Another common thing that people ask is, well, I'm not doing this all the time because my patients may not want to be involved. But that's actually not correct either in terms of what we know from the research. So a study of almost 3,000 participants found that most people, regardless of their demographic characteristics or their background, wanted to be offered some choices. And only about half of them wanted to defer the final decision to their patients. But most of them still wanted to engage in some deliberation about options. So we talk about this in a more recent paper, the difference between deliberating and determining the final choice. Some people think that maybe the patient's preferences for involvement might differ across invasive or medical procedures or screening decisions. But in invasive medical procedures, about 80% of people wanted shared decision-making or patient-led decisions, and 93% of them at least wanted some risk information shared with them. And when we looked at when people looked at other decisions, only 3 to 8% of patients say they want no role at all in decision-making. So it's not a it's not an accurate perception that patients across different characteristics don't want to engage. They do want to engage. They just may vary in the extent they want to engage. So I think that we can take a statement like this one from a patient and call this shared decision making. My preferences are to cure the disease as quickly as possible, but I would still like to continue working through treatment if possible. I'm torn between option A and B. What do you think I should do? So a lot of clinicians say, well, patients just ask me, what would you do in this situation? You can still engage in shared decision-making and provide some recommendation based on the evidence and the values that patients express. But without giving them the chance to engage and deliberate, then they don't have the opportunity to share their preferences. So one of the reasons why patients might tell you up front that they may not want to engage is they may not know the complexity of the decision. So limited knowledge can lead people to say they want to defer decision-making, and they can't necessarily articulate their preferences if they have some inaccurate or missing information. So they may not be able to tell you what they value or what they prefer about options or how they might trade off these options if you're not clear on the nature of the decision. So we suggested in a BMJ paper recently that we should start by acknowledging that there is clinical equipoise or that there is a decision to be made and recognize some of the trade-offs between options before we offer people treatment choices. And then once patients are informed, they can decide whether they want more or less decision involvement. So again, they could say, I still want you to tell me what you think I should do, but I at least want to acknowledge the decision and give you some of my preferences about working through treatment or curing the disease as quickly as possible. Some of the challenges for clinicians are that we still need to investigate in a research context or whether patients can really clearly articulate their preferences, especially in a time-sensitive clinical visit, and whether clinicians bias the process a bit when patients are making decisions based on unfamiliar or high stakes or uncertain data, and whether or not preferences might change across several conversations. We really haven't tackled this as a research community yet, but these are still some lingering issues in terms of clarifying preferences for engagement. But some people feel that using decision support tools or decision support interventions might help clarify some of these challenges by being able to have a record of these discussions across visits and being able to allow patients to deliberate outside of the office visit. So decision support tools or decision aids are designed to help people make these deliberative choices by providing information and providing some outcomes relevant to a person's health status. They're also called decision aids, decision support tools, decision support systems, interactive health communication tools, shared decision-making programs, or even sometimes risk communication tools, although that's a narrow piece of decision support interventions. But the core elements of all of these are some tailored information provision or knowledge, some exercises to support values clarification, some guidance about how to arrive at decisions or some support through the decision, and the end goal is to facilitate these informed preference-sensitive decisions and sometimes to document what patients would like to discuss with the provider during a visit. The most recent Cochrane review in 2014 found very strong evidence that decision support interventions improve knowledge compared to usual care, so there's high-quality evidence for that. Patients tend to feel more informed and clearer about their preferences after viewing these tools. There's moderate evidence that decision support tools give patients more accurate expectations of what care can accomplish, so they're more prepared to understand what the outcomes could be, and they participate more in decisions. Patients also make more value-consistent choices, and there's less evidence for the fact that they might lead to more conservative decisions. People often ask, you know, if we give people decision support interventions, will this save costs or lead people to choose less invasive options? That may be true for things like PSA testing and elective surgery, but it has a variable effect on other choices. So we really can't say across the board that they lead to less invasive choices. They do tend to improve patient clinical communication, and they do tend to be better for knowledge and decisional conflict the more detail you provide. So there are some simpler tools and some more complex tools, and the more complex tools tend to improve knowledge and reduce decisional conflict more. They don't tend to worsen health outcomes, and patients feel fairly satisfied with them. And I'm just going to show some screenshots of the different forms that decision support interventions can take. This is a tool that was developed by HealthWise, and some of the HealthWise tools are pretty comprehensive. They go through information. They have screens to help people compare options side by side. They have screens to help people clarify their values using sliding bars. They have ways that patients can quiz themselves in a sort of teach-back type intervention. And they give summaries that you can take to a clinician or even to a family member to show them where people are leaning in their decision. There are also some paper-based tools or in-consultation tools. This is one developed at Mayo Clinic that is about diabetes medication, and this is only a small screenshot of what they've developed. There's more than these cards, but you can even simplify it to break them down for use during the consultation by taking individual cards or factors that might influence people's choices and having a discussion about some of these options. So here, these are cards about diabetes medications, and they put factors that might patients might value at the top, so things like weight change, low blood sugar. Clinicians are obviously interested in blood sugar reduction from these medications, and it describes how each might affect those different attributes. This is an example of an option grid about breast cancer surgery, and this is just a one-page handout that clinicians and patients can use together either during a consultation or patients can look at it after, but it goes through in a frequently asked question format. So you can see they range in complexity and visual presentation. But most clinicians talk about barriers to implementing decision tools, particularly focused on time. The most common thing people say is that I don't have the time to do this during a really busy office visit. The research shows that there's mixed effect on the impact of decision support tools on time. So some studies show that they have no effect on the consultation length, or they can actually save time because people feel more prepared for their decision by going through some of these tools before the consultation. So they may ask more high-quality questions or questions about specific values or preferences as opposed to general information about the disease. But others show, as one might expect, they could increase consultation length because they give people more detail than they might receive just verbally in the consultation. There are other time factors, like the time it takes to train in shared decision making or train in decision support interventions, the time it might take to meet for follow-up visits if we're truly engaging in this collaborative process. We may want to evaluate how this choice is working, and people incorporate that into this barrier of time constraint. But like most interventions that are new, they encounter the same types of barriers. So most of us in the research community will say, well, you know, that may be true of evidence-based guidelines for lots of different diseases, that initially they do take more time, but if they're ethical and we support them based on principles of patient-centered care, we find a way to incorporate them anyway. The next most common barriers are people feel that some decision tools don't apply to their specific patient characteristics, or that patients want a different model that doesn't fit with shared decision making, which we've addressed earlier in the research on patient preferences for involvement. And clinicians feel maybe their patients aren't really willing to play a role, or they don't want to discuss this with us about how much they want to participate. They just want to come and be seen and have this efficient consultation. But when providers are motivated and perceive that this has a positive impact on the clinical process, and they do see support in research findings on patient outcomes that they care about, then they're much more likely to engage in shared decision making and use decision support interventions. So for those of you researching shared decision making, if you can use or measure in your research studies patient outcomes that are appropriate and show that your decision support interventions or your processes that you're modeling have a positive impact on the process, you may be more likely to get uptake of your interventions. The most recent Cochrane review had multiple different formats for decision support tools, print-based, multimedia tools, digital or online decision support tools, and some combinations used both before and after visits. And we did a qualitative study to see whether or not clinicians differed in their perceptions of these tools depending on the format that they took. I just wanted to show some quotes that might resonate with the clinicians out there. One OBGYN commented that the fact that this paper-based DESE is in all in one page is just really easy for the patient to read, and it's easy to go through quickly while you're in the office. So if it's a paper-based tool, maybe something that's in one page might simplify the process. An internal medicine clinician described that when someone hears they have cancer, it takes a couple of visits to let that sink in before even talking about treatment options. So having a digital decision support tool at home to let that sink in would really help. So it may be for different contexts, we might need to consider the format of our decision support tools. A surgeon described that she thinks that both are very resourceful and useful, so both digital and paper-based formats. I would try to have as many different formats available because different patients might prefer different ways. Some of the younger patients might prefer electronic versions, which is a format they are comfortable with, and maybe some older patients would prefer the paper format or a video format. So the more formats, the better. So if you're in the interest of developing a decision support tool, you might want to consider your end users in terms of the format you choose. This is something that tends to resonate with a lot of people. We do have computers in the clinic rooms, but it takes so long for them to load anything. I have to log in, and then it freezes. Then I have to unfreeze it, and then I have to get on the website, where pulling out a pencil and paper thing would be so much more accessible. So this was a medical oncologist who described some of the challenges with digital decision support tools if they're being used during consultations. So you have the copy of these slides. I'll let you read the rest of the quotes. But I thought it was interesting to hear how different people from different specialty areas describe some of these challenges and ways we can overcome them. So in terms of where we are in the field, shifting back to implementation, we had a conference a few years ago where we talked about some of the challenges implementing shared decision making in practice and related it to comparative effectiveness research. You may hear these terms used nationally when we're describing research methods that can incorporate shared decision making but go beyond that. So comparative effectiveness research actually takes uncertain evidence and tries to compare different interventions to see which one might work best for which patients under which conditions. And we were describing shared decision making as one of the tools for implementing some of the results of CER into practice. So we may get some of this research on what works best for whom under what conditions, and then we need to talk about that with patients in terms of patient-centered outcomes that matter to them and to other stakeholders. So taking this effectiveness of treatments in practice and then implementing it into the clinical encounter. So some of the tools can include shared decision making, but can also involve evidence-based medicine and patient-centered care. And of course, our end goal is through all of this research is to improve patient outcomes like their health or quality of life and other things. So this is a nice framework for framing your research studies if you're interested in looking at how we can actually implement shared decision making through this implementation framework. And a lot of people ask, well, why bother? And a lot of it is because the evidence for what we know is quite uncertain. So we know now, based on the most recent data I can find on BMJ's Clinical Effectiveness Series, which actually looks at the state of randomized trials across 3,000 treatments, so across all different disease areas. And 50% of what we know from these trials is of unknown effectiveness. And there's an additional 7% in the purple part of the pie that's a trade-off between benefits and harms. So these are situations where we really need shared decision making, again, to implement some of the results from these trials. They could be comparative effectiveness trials, or they could be back in this model of more basic trials looking for at clinical efficacy. So we really don't know a lot of what we're practicing in medicine in terms of how they apply to individual patients in the consultation room. Some of the challenges of working on comparative effectiveness research and shared decision making in practice are pretty similar. We really have, as a field, some misconceptions about some of the goals and challenging institutional and cultural norms that might not support CER and shared decision making. And again, this time barrier comes up over and over again about resources to learn about the skills needed. So some of the solutions we proposed from this conference were engaging stakeholders in the design and evaluation of studies and encouraging some transparency about generating, synthesizing, and communicating evidence through shared decision making. If you're working in institutions that where there are some challenging cultural norms, there are places where we can work through administrative and infrastructure support. People suggest things like incorporating nurses or medical support staff prior to the physician-patient interaction that can help with some of these barriers in terms of lack of computers in the consultation room or lack of time during the encounter where you're discussing some of this evidence. And economic incentives are things clinicians often bring up. Although we don't like to talk about it, sometimes we need to start with motivating factors that come from external rewards before people then start seeing the internal motivation and benefits to their practice. Institutional training grants can help with training trainees about research evidence and shared decision making, because we know it's harder to change people's behavior once they've been in practice for a long time. And embedding shared decision making and CER training into existing programs like supplemental modules to training in evidence-based medicine is a good place to start. This can help so that we don't have to develop something new and we can just incorporate these into existing trainings. So some of the places that are already doing this are Dartmouth Medical Center. They have a great website that goes through different, they call them trigger tapes. You can actually see what shared decision making looks like in practice. And you can see what usual care looks like, and you can look and compare the two if you're interested in learning what that how they might differ. The Mayo Clinic has a National Resource Center in Shared Decision Making, and they're part of the Minnesota Shared Decision Making Collaborative, which actually goes through statewide shared decision making implementation and questions. At UCSF, they have different things available, but one of the things that was highlighted by the AHRQ as an innovation in shared decision making is something called a scoped note, and it's kind of like a question prompt list that people can patients can create in advance of a consultation to help them ask the right questions about their choices. I think it stands for situations, choices, options. I think there's something about preparedness and evidence. So they go through different parts of the decision. Washington State actually created statewide legislation that authorized pilot projects on shared decision making's impact on both use and cost across preference-sensitive services. And one of the things that's really interesting about their implementation is that they actually created this policy where they had a higher level of malpractice protection when shared decision making was used. A lot of people are fearful that giving people patients choices might lead them to make the wrong choice, quote unquote, even though there is no wrong choice when the evidence is uncertain. Clinicians are often worried that patients might do something that's not consistent with evidence-based guidelines. Now, in shared decision-making examples where it's appropriate, there really isn't an option that's worse or better, otherwise we would just be practicing evidence-based medicine. But nonetheless, there are places where, let's say, a jury wouldn't necessarily know that. So they implemented higher level of malpractice protection for people that use certified decision tools that were certified by the state. People may have heard of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. There's national legislation that actually incorporates a large section on shared decision making. Unfortunately, that's not funded to do anything, but it does mention the importance of shared decision making, so people feel pretty optimistic that at least we're acknowledging the benefits of shared decision-making nationally. Although there have been many bills that have been proposed but not passed. So one of them was the federal help bill that would have provided funding for the development and production of tools, of decision tools, provider education and how to use these, providing funding for resource centers that would provide technical assistance in shared decision making, where places would work to develop standards and certification for decision tools, and provider performance measures. Unfortunately, this was not funded, but nonetheless, I bring it up because I think it's interesting to look at national legislation that has at least been proposed in this area. I'm not sure people know about some of the congressional leadership and their support for shared decision-making in principle, if not funding. The Medicare Patient Choices Act also proposed some funding for shared decision-making, and they actually proposed pilot programs that, if passed, would have occurred in three different phases. So a three-year pilot for providers that would be considered early adopters, a three-year pilot then where providers would be eligible to get reimbursed for using decision tools, so there's the economic incentives. And then after those 6 years, providers would then be required to use decision aids for preference-sensitive conditions. So again, this didn't pass, but I thought that was interesting that they had a very detailed process that through which they would lead to implementation of shared decision-making or decision support tools. In Vermont, they've proposed legislation that would require a plan for a demonstration project that was similar to Washington State's, and it would require a statewide analysis on variation in care, so whether or not people received care differently depending on where they lived in the state. That did not pass yet, but has been proposed. And in Minnesota, in their shared decision-making collaborative, they have some questions where they asked about how we can reliably identify and engage patients in the process of care, how they can best provide shared decision-making across different settings. They include rural settings here and various types of decisions to make it efficient and effective, and how they should reimburse providers for shared decision-making, whether they should, and if so, how, and then physician training in shared decision-making. They do have some pilot work going on at the Mayo Clinic, at Stillwater Medical Group, and Health Partners, and they actually include community education and some social marketing. So one of the challenges that people talk about on a policy level is how do we raise awareness about shared decision-making so people can understand that it's something we support for patient-centered care and that it's not about rationing, for example, or taking care away from people when it's needed. And it's not about that. It's actually about supporting patients' choices when there's multiple options available. But they engaged in some education so that when patients are the recipients of shared decision-making or when family members perceive that that organizations are engaging in shared decision-making, they don't fear these inaccurate perceptions. So they have a statewide campaign to talk about this and to talk about practice variation in different patterns. And this is just a little summary chart for different places that are working on some of implementation of shared decision making. There are some individual organization guidelines like the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network, that talks about cancer guidelines for many decisions. And there are other states that are thinking about proposing some statewide demonstration projects, but none that I know of besides Washington State have actually been implemented, although Minnesota is getting closer. So I wanted to leave some time for questions. I know I ran through them rather quickly, and I wanted to make sure we could have time for discussion about some of your questions and challenges that you see in your practice or in your research.
Excellent. Thank you very much. For those attendees that joined us after the top of the hour, to submit your question or comment, please use the question section of the GoToWebinar dashboard that's on the right-hand side of your screen. To open the question section, just click the plus sign next to the word questions. That will expand the dialog box, and then you can type your question or comment in, and we'll read those in the order that they are received. The first question we have came in towards the beginning of the session. One of the biggest barriers I've found with implementation of shared decision-making is the notion that, quote, we are already doing that. Do you have any suggestions on how to overcome this well-entrenched belief?
Yeah, so that's part of why I raised that earlier about providers, even in the class that I teach on shared decision making, often think, you know, we're already doing this. And I usually start by acknowledging that most providers are doing components of this. At least people who have trained recently support patient-centered care and engage in patients and to some degree ask them about their preferences. So one of the things that can really help is starting by acknowledging that, you know, we recognize that you're doing this and you're doing pieces of this and you support this process, so people don't feel attacked or that we're criticizing their process or their clinical care. You know, most clinicians are really interested in what's best for patients. But it's a really difficult process, and it involves many different aspects of decision process. And so I also show some trigger tapes that, let's say, Dartmouth has. There are some that are available at other institutions as well. I provide some examples of what shared decision making looks like, and start by giving even quotes from patients about when they felt that this wasn't happening in practice and how they perceived that barrier. And then, you know, providers sometimes then realize, oh, right, that's true. You know, I have had patients say that, or, oh, I didn't realize patients feel that way or that they want so much involvement. So it can sort of break down some of that perception that this is happening.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, how effective do you think shared decision making is in terms of quality improvement measures, specifically in terms of specialty care, since there is stronger focus on quality measures in primary care and not as much in specialty care?
Yeah, so quality improvement measures are challenging because we really haven't agreed yet on across all different areas what we should be looking for in terms of quality. One of the biggest that people wonder about is patient satisfaction, which is now being included as a quality indicator. And I actually have found in my own work and shared decision making that it can actually lead to different changes in satisfaction. Some people might actually feel less satisfied when they realize how uncertain the situations are in medicine. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Most people, let's say if you have a cancer diagnosis, wouldn't be pretty excited to hear that we don't really know what's best for you, you know, that people want the magic pill with no side effects that can cure their cancer. And we don't really have that. So they might report lower satisfaction initially if they recognize how uncertain the evidence is, but they actually report more satisfaction with the process of making a decision. So if you're measuring some of these outcomes, I actually don't like to use satisfaction as a primary outcome for that reason, because it may be that it could be a little lower, and that's actually a good thing from an ethical standpoint and an evidence-based medicine standpoint. We have found that going through shared decision-making in a patient-centered way can improve satisfaction after patients realize that there is uncertain evidence, but that it has to be done delicately. So I tend to use things like knowledge, behavior and changes, quality of life indicators, and satisfaction with the process to measure some outcomes of decision tools or shared decision making. In terms of specialty care overall, it really depends on the setting, but we haven't really agreed yet on uniform quality indicators.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, first off, fabulous presentation. Can you expand a bit on how to document the process of shared decision making so other providers in the electronic medical record know that it is happening?
Thank you. Yeah, that's unfortunately, because of our healthcare system, we don't really have a uniform electronic record either. So different institutions handle this differently. In Washington State, I know they have a very clear process because they propose the statewide legislation. So what they do is they have evidence-based tools, and they can actually link the summary pages to the medical records, or they can actually have a way to do this as part of informed consent. So they document it during the process of informed consent for elective medical procedures. At our institution, at Washington University, it's really up to the individual provider, and a lot of times it's just a written note that just says, discussed pros and cons of treatment, or discussed patient preferences and what those preferences are. But our university is still working on a improved electronic record form. So a lot of this really depends on institution-specific factors, unless there's statewide or national legislation to try to unify what we're doing in that regard.
Thank you for that reply. The next question we have, please describe when would shared decision-making not be appropriate for cognitively able patients? In my experience, both personally and professionally, most physicians do not believe patients, quote, understand the option that no is not an option.
That's right. So this is a tricky question because there are differences across the field in whether people think shared decision making should be done across every decision that we talk about in medicine, because nothing is foolproof. You know, there's no intervention that has a 0% risk. And some people think we only really engage in this for what we describe as preference sensitive choices. And if we do this across all conditions, then we would be spending, you know, the entire day with one patient because there's so much to discuss. I tend to believe we should, at the bare minimum, engage in this with preference-sensitive choices where there's certainly where there's a point of equipoise, or even when there's evidence that falls into these gray area categories where evidence might tilt towards one treatment or another, but it really depends on individual patient factors that we're not aware of, or individual preferences that could still be considered reasonable options if patients were to choose something. So, for example, a classic example of a point of equipoise is surgery decisions for early stage breast cancer, where a lumpectomy or a mastectomy are both perfectly reasonable choices and just have different trade-offs in terms of side effects of treatment or length of time of engaging in treatment, the size of the surgery, whether or not someone needs radiation or not, and factors like that. But we could also engage in shared decision-making for situations like vaccination, which has become a pretty hot topic. And even though the evidence is strongly supporting vaccine decisions, patients might feel hesitant for personal reasons, and that can actually be overcome through a very open discussion of evidence and patients' values. And it may be that patients aren't aware of some of the evidence about vaccines, and going through a shared decision-making-like process can actually help them better match their choices to their preferences, since most parents' preferences are not to do harm to their children. So people can talk about shared decision-making across many different situations. I would say there are a few times where it's not appropriate, and that's when there's something that's an emergency and we really can't engage patients in the discussion. There are people who have done shared decision making in the emergency room, but for low risk chest pain to decide whether or not to admit and other things like that. But when there's a true emergency and we need to act quickly, clinicians just need to use best guidelines and implement patients who are in the ICU who may not be able to engage, and there's no family member to engage, patients who don't have capacity, and we need to have a proxy to make decisions, and that proxy is not actually engaging in the process. So there are situations like that where it's clearly not appropriate, but most of the time it's a gray area, and you may find different people have different beliefs about how to do this in situations where there might be stronger evidence.
Thank you. And the second portion of that question is, what about routine medication decisions?
Routine medication decisions. So I guess that would be things like statins or hypertension medications, or maybe even antibiotics. I hope I'm interpreting that routine medications correctly. And there are people who use shared decision making for sure for things like hypertension medications, because even when we recommend that somebody take a medication, for example, there are still choices about which medication to take, or diabetes medications, which diabetes medication might work for me. And then we can think about even something like antibiotics. We tend to know that, you know, for bacterial infections, antibiotics are a good choice. But I think it was Annie LeBlanc, I can check on that, who looked at shared decision-making about antibiotics in pediatric situations, because there are some situations where bacterial infections might clear up on their own with time. And so even if patients want to take them, maybe there's a choice about timing and when to start it to see if the infection clears up on its own before we overprescribe. So even in those situations, we can incorporate elements of shared decision making, and it really depends on the context and how the decision is being approached.
Thank you. The next question, how do you implement shared decision making at the family level? For instance, if a health decision needs to be made for a child, do you incorporate the child's wishes? And if so, how do you balance the child's preference with the parents or guardians?
Yeah, that's a really challenging situation. There was actually just an article published last month in Medical Decision Making by Ellen Lipstein and Bill Brinkman and a few others on decision making with pediatric cases. So some of this depends on the age of the child. So obviously for adolescents, this might differ than for much younger children. But even for adults, this comes into play when we have spouses involved in the room. And who do we engage first when it's a real family choice about implementation and follow-up care and maybe some caregiving needs? There are some models for engaging in this in pediatric settings that involve, talking to the person who's the primary decision maker, which would be the parent, but making sure that the children are involved. There are also models for this in specific disease areas like diabetes, for example, type 1 diabetes that might start in childhood, but during adolescence, the child might be taking over some of that role. So the conversation might shift a bit from talking more to the parents and then moving towards the children. Similarly with HPV vaccination decisions, where if somebody's considering this for their 9-year-old, it might differ than when someone's considering this for their adolescent or older teen. So there's really not one best way to do this, but making sure that everyone's input is taken into account and everyone feels heard while focusing primarily on the patient in the end and can be the best approach. But I would take a look at that recent paper that just came out last month because they propose a really neat model for doing this, particularly with children.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, CMS recently required that to get reimbursed for lung cancer screenings, physicians had to have a shared decision-making visit and use a decision aid. Are there other examples where a decision aid has been required?
That was a very interesting decision on their part, and part of that was because there is so much confusion from primary care providers and even some specialty providers about who's considered high risk, who would meet these guidelines for low-dose CT, and a lot of people were still sending people for x-rays, and they still are sending people for chest x-rays, which isn't considered evidence-based. So there are some really great lung cancer screening decision tools out there now, and there's still more being developed. In other contexts, I don't know of very many other places that have required shared decision making, but I do know of many places that have suggested or strongly encouraged. So the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force talks about shared decision making being appropriate for multiple different types of cancer screening, so colorectal cancer screening, prostate cancer screening, and mammography screening. The NCCN clinical guidelines, they actually grade evidence from low evidence to strong evidence, and so they require shared decision-making conversations for those low evidence categories, or they suggest it, but I don't know of others that have required it in terms of payment or documentation besides the lung cancer screening example.
Thank you. The final pending question, how can developers of evidence-based clinical practice guidelines positively influence shared decision-making implementation? Create guidelines-derived DAs? Include more shared decision-making-related recommendations?
Yeah, I think we are moving in this direction. People who are coming up with these practice guidelines through the question proposed, so including more shared decision-making recommendations. But I also think that people making these decisions about evidence-based practice can do a little more than just talk about recommendations, and they can actually incorporate training into evidence-based practice CME training, because one of the things that happens when we recommend things, if people don't know how to do it, then we think we're already engaging in the process, or we just tend to ignore it and think, okay, well, that's great, but it's never going to work in this context, or I'm already doing this, and here's how. So I think, although that's not necessarily the role of the guideline developers, I think if there's something more concrete than just suggesting it, which is what we currently do now, you know, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, MCCN, and other organizations already mention this quite frequently, and it's still not really being implemented. I think we need a lot more on the how. So teaming up with the training through CME credits, for example, continuing professional development courses, and other places like that, maybe even tagging on modules to national meetings and such can probably impact the practice a little bit more than just making these general recommendations.
Thank you. As I mentioned, that is the final pending question, so I'd like to give you the opportunity to make any concluding comments to our audience, if you'd like.
Thank you very much for listening and submitting some of these questions. These are great, and I look forward to working with some of you in the field. It sounds like many of you are interested in some of this research, so feel free to get in touch if you have other things after this presentation that you want to talk about in terms of your specific research areas.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you coming and lending your expertise to the field and for making yourself available for questions after the fact. And, of course, thank you to our attendees for joining us. As I mentioned, we have recorded today's presentation, and you will receive a follow-up email with a link leading to the recording if you'd like to pass that along to colleagues. As you exit out of today's session, please note that a feedback survey will pop up on your screen, so please take just a moment to fill out those few questions. We do look at them very closely, and it helps us to improve our presentations as well as choose new content for sessions to support. So once again, thank you everyone for joining us, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar. Have a great day.